Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM.
Music too?
Honey, I live music. Morning, noon, a whole night. Everything else is just icing on the cake, you dig?
I do.
This is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special. John Kelly here, but tonight I don't pick the music. We get a guest to pick the music. And tonight my guest is Una Monaghan, who is a composer, a harpist and a sound artist. And Una's with me in the studio. I'm glad to have you here, Una. I've been curious about your work for some time.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
So, Una, I can tell from your accent you're not from Donnybrook, Dublin 4.
I'm not. I'm from West Belfast, Andersonstown.
Andytown,
if you want to correct me.
So if you say you're from Andersonstown, is that you being posh?
I don't know. I guess I've tried to say things how they're written, but I've definitely been corrected, and my sisters have been corrected on more than one occasion.
Yeah. So you were growing up in Belfast then. 1980s Belfast was still a tough place.
Yeah, although I suppose at the time I didn't quite realise it. It's more every day now thinking how things were then that you would realise. And I think everyone has their own wee interesting stories that happened to them that they didn't notice at the time, but maybe now you put in context on how we are now and you realise, wow, if that were to happen now, I would really find that strange.
I know. So this was Andersonstown, 1980s, and I'm curious to know how you get from there to being a sound artist and composer. But we'll start with the harp, because I presume there was some access to playing the harp in Belfast.
There was after a while. Mummy says that, well, there was a piano in our house, and I think we were storing it for somebody, and that piano was still there. So
you never played it. No?
Well, I think that's my earliest musical memory. There was this piano book, and it was the first way to learn how to read music, and there were wee imps in it. I think it was Thompson Piano Tutor. And so Mammy, it was, you know, one thumb, C, 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 one thumb. And I remember that, Mammy just helping us learn how to do that. But my two older sisters and three younger sisters and a brother. And so the older one played the fiddle and then the pipes. And Mammy said, well, what would you like to play? And apparently I just said the harp. And it wasn't like to play, it was I'm gonna play the harp. And so that was a bit of an issue because there was no harp in sight and no harp teacher in sight. And we're not quite sure why that happened. I think it might be something to do with the size of a harp in an orchestra. If you come in the back room of an orchestra and there's a harp on the stage, you can hear the noise, and if you're only wee, all you can see is the harp. So,
but had you actually seen a harp in real life before you decided you wanted to play one?
I think that's what happened. Yeah. I think we came in the back of a school or maybe an orchestra concert of some description in the back row, and all I could see was this big gold thing, but I could hear the noise.
Yeah.
So I said, what's that? And they said, a harp. And I said, all right. So maybe it's that I thought that's the noise that came out of it and kind of latched on to it at that point. But there wasn't one around. So Mommy kept saying, well, that's nice, here's a fiddle. Or that's nice, here's a whistle. And it was only in 1992, when there was a big bicentenary of the Harp Festival in Belfast, that there was a week of lessons that a beginner could go to. It was run by Janet Harbison. And Mommy said, thanks be to God, we can get this child a harp. So I rented one then during that week. And
now, the harp that you started to play on, was it an Irish harp or was it a concert harp?
Yeah, tiny wee rented Irish harp for that week. And then Jan Mouliart, who's a maker in Meath, gave a harp to be given to a beginner who showed promise at that festival, and that's how I got my first harp.
Wow. And did you take to it immediately?
Loved it.
Right.
Yeah, and I just haven't really stopped since.
And is it a complicated instrument to learn?
The thing with the harp is that you're not encouraged to develop good technique early on, because the instrument kind of plays itself. It's really hard to make a horrible noise on a harp. Like, if you're playing the fiddle, you've got issues there for a while in terms of getting tone.
Yeah.
And people around you have to put up with some awful noises before you'll get good ones. Mm-hmm. Whereas a harp, as soon as you play that, you know, it sounds lovely. And so the problem with learning the harp is making yourself do it well whenever it already sounds good.
Ah, right.
I think.
And what about tuning? Big issues with tuning with harps, isn't it?
Depends on the harp. They settle.
Right.
So I've had mine a good few years now and it's pretty good.
Well, you mentioned Janet Harbison. Maybe we'll start with her. A name I know from my time in Belfast. Did a lot of amazing work.
Amazing work.
Her own, really.
Yeah. Really formative in terms of my musical education. There's such a lot of things I got out of playing with the harp orchestra at that time. And I mean, unison playing for a start. It was the first time, you know, the only time that you're going to hear 25 to 30 harps all at once. And that sound of multiple harps, and I later understood multiple instruments of any kind, but multiple harps at once really struck me, has never left me. And you can put that in different acoustics as well. But even the rehearsals for that harp orchestra used to just really affect me, the sound of many harps at once, even before you start arranging it.
And what age were you when you joined this orchestra?
I think I would have been 13.
13.
And she organised tours. Like, that was the first time I'd been on a boat, a plane, a hotel. You know, there were things outside of the music that really got me too, but it was the first time sound engineering hit me. So there was a lot to do with the harp orchestra that was a first for me.
So what are we going to hear in Amra?
Yes, this is a piece from Column Kill, which is, I think, Janet wrote in 1997, and it was to commemorate the birth of St. Columba. Oh. So this suite was a suite of music with soprano and choirs, and this piece is one of the harp pieces.
Janet Harbison and the Belfast Harp Orchestra. There, the Belfast Harp Orchestra, Janet Harbison there, Amra, the Harper's Elegy from the Columban Suite. And it's the first choice tonight of Una Monaghan, who's with me. Una's from Belfast. She's a harpist, she's a composer and a sound artist. And we have a lot of stuff to get into before the programme's out. But we're back in the early days in Belfast, and you took a notion of the harp. Your mother did her best and finally got you one. How did you get this harp moved around the place?
Well, my harp lived in a sleeping bag for long enough because it came with no cover. So on the back, the shoulder of that harp, there's multiple sleeping bag zip marks.
Okay.
Still to now, etched into the wood. But after I started learning with Janet then, she lived in Hollywood and we had no car at the time. So my auntie would come and pick up the harp at 8 a.m. on her way to work, leave it in the garden at Janet's house. Janet would come out and get it and bring it in when she got up.
She'd leave it in the garden?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just a wee short period of time because my auntie was going really early to work. And so that was brought in. And then the harp was in Janet's house for me to get a train from Belfast after school and have the lesson. And then we would get a train back with a hot sausage roll on the way home, which to me was the best part of the whole thing. And then my auntie would bring the harp home on the way home again.
Wow. And it was your focus in completely on traditional music?
At that time, on the harp, it was. I did also start to play violin, possibly before the harp. I found the violin, the bow hold, to be really hard.
Mm.
And I later came back to it as a traditional player, tried to. somewhat because, you know, bringing a harp around and actually fitting in traditional contexts was at the time a wee bit difficult.
What opportunities did you have to play music on a harp at the time? Because you know, you wouldn't see a harp at a session, but then you would have been too young to be at a proper session anyway, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, by the time I was 15, 16, I was just going to the sessions that were around about. There was one, the Roddy McCauley Club at the top of the Andersonstown Road, different ones in town, in with Loch Lee in the Coulterland on the Falls Road in St Gall's. So there were sessions for kids. I was playing in the flats. I was going to whatever festivals I was able to manage.
And is the harp welcomed into those scenarios, into a session?
Okay, it definitely is now.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was never unwelcome that I could see, but what it was it was obvious. You know, you can't sneak in with a harp. And sometimes in sessions, there's a lot of sneaking in goes on.
Byron players mostly.
So, yeah, I find it frustrating that you couldn't wander in the back door.
Yeah.
If you arrived, people noticed you'd arrive. And then the worst thing was, well, maybe it was lovely. They were going to ask you to play something on your own.
Yeah.
Mostly because they couldn't hear you. And then sometimes they felt it was kind of nice to ask you to play on your own. But then the knowledge that at the age of 15 that you're going to a session and you're likely to be asked to play on your own, it's a bit daunting.
Yeah.
So I tried to play fiddle and then played a bit of concertina as well.
And you're only, you know, when you were still 13, 14 and so on, I'm thinking of all your pals on the Andersons Down Road, the people you were at school with. Were you on your own or were there others with a similar musical interests?
There was a lot of traditional music about the place. Mm. I mean, I would have played in Common Cools in my school. There was great music in Bunscull Football First Year where I grew up. Great singing tradition, an Irish language singing tradition. Paddy Davey ran a whole series of music classes from his house. There was great Belfast traditions of musicians. I suppose at the time, because everything was kind of based in your area in Belfast, you knew the ones that were around.
Mm.
And then there was seven of us in the house, so you were going to be playing with your sisters and my brother.
But you weren't lured away by the bright lights of the local disco and all the rest of it, were you?
God, tried like, yeah. But didn't really have much access to that kind of music. And as far as I remember it, we didn't really have much to play music on, bar the instruments. Like,
right, no record player
there wasn't
in the house?
No, not in the house. And so all of my music was more in person. And this had an effect on what I knew of music as I got older, because I found it hard to understand what era different pieces of music were from, because I'd no real appreciation of when it came out.
Uh-huh.
So I would hear a piece of music I loved and I'd just automatically presume it was from back in the day because I'd missed out on that knowledge in a way.
Yeah.
Which meant that I sometimes missed out on going to live gigs from people presuming that they weren't touring anymore. When in actual fact, looking back now, music I really liked had only come out the previous month and I just didn't know that.
Yeah.
So
it's getting like that again now, because the kids are picking up music without any context. You know, they hear one track here and one track here and one track from one album. They like a song. They don't necessarily go and buy all the albums by that person. So that kind of, whereas I grew up in an era where you know, if you liked a particular artist, you went and followed that. You bought every album, you know, you kind of pursued it in a very strict way. And you needed to know who was when and where and how.
Yeah.
You needed all that. Well,
but there was a chronology there that maybe came with the music that you were interested in. Mm. I mean, I do follow people.
Mm.
I followed the Beach Boys kind of literally. Like,
well, then where did you hear the Beach Boys then? If you had no record player in the house?
I knew Mammy really liked them, but she didn't have any records, but I knew that when she was young that was the band she liked, but okay. I knew that as a concept without knowing what they sounded like. And I remember we were sitting in a car in Gidor in Donegal and we were just waiting on something, probably waiting on someone to get out of a music lesson. It happened a lot. And Caroline Noe came on the radio and Mammy said, "That's the Beach Boys."
That's a great
and I
song.
Listened really intently to the words of that music, which is really sad, you know. Mm. Where did your long hair go? And that was the first time I remember hearing them, when I was middle teenager, and I got really into them when I was 17 to 20 with two other Belfast musicians, Jeff Gatt and Dominic O'Neill. And we used to kind of follow them about then. I've met Brian Wilson from sitting in a London underground car park after his gig at the festival hall,
on
my own.
Right, you really did.
But I didn't know if he was coming out. He just sort of wandered out of the lift. That's where his car was parked. I was sitting underneath the hall sort of thinking, whoa, what was that? Like, it was one of the gigs. It was either the Pet Sounds one or the Smile one that he did in the middle of the 2000s there. So, yeah, we sort of have followed them a wee bit. But those two musicians in Belfast were mental about them. And looking back, the tune, all the big Beach Boys tunes, like Caroline No wasn't indicative really of what I came to know as them, but it was the first one I heard.
Do You Want to Dance, the Beach Boys? I actually thought you might have picked something like Caroline No, or, you know, something from Pet Sounds. Or
I thought about this, and the, those are the fancy ones that that have a lot of the analysis. But you see, Do You Want to Dance in that kind of mood? That's what got me in the heart. Like, there's a joy there. And that's what I first loved about the Beach Boys.
Terrific. Other pop music, were you listening to anything else in the 1980s? I suppose we're talking mid to late 80s at this stage, are we?
Well, no, 90s, really. 90s, I think when I was wishing for pop. So, some dance. Anything I could get, really. I remember Atlantic 252 was a radio station that we could find. Now I like Taylor Swift.
That's all right. So, back to the harp for now. At this early stage, you probably weren't thinking about other things you could do with the music and other things you could do with the harp. And I'm thinking of what you do now. Was there any sign of that back then, listening to forms of music that might have led you down that road of experimenting with sound and with technology and all the rest of it?
I do remember being really interested in the equipment. It started at a harp orchestra concert. We played in some really big halls at the time, and like the Birmingham Symphony, it was really big. And so we had an engineer, and every one of those harps had a two-piece pickup on them. And the engineer at the time would go through each harp player, and you'd have to play solo, and he would then, you know, crank the gain, and suddenly what was in your instrument at your ear would expand into this huge hall.
Mm-hmm.
And the change in the sound from your instrument to the hall was a change that I just loved. Hearing that from stage, hearing your music go out and become much bigger, and the sound of it change as it was amplified. So that just made me really interested in sound engineering. And I didn't know at the time that it's something I could do. I had no way into it. Studied music for GCSE and A-level, and at that time you could pick one module, and not all schools were able to do it because you needed the equipment and things. So where it was possible for me to pick a module, I did. And then I got the work experience, and I was doing science A-levels, so physics, chemistry, maths and music. And with those A-levels, the school would kind of encourage you to get work experience at a hospital or somewhere that would maybe fit with your subject choices. And I thought to myself, like, I'm doing all right in these subjects. If I want to become a doctor, I could apply for it and then it'd hopefully end up in the hospital. Whereas this is the only week I'm going to get out of school to go into a recording studio. So to my career teacher's dismay, I was like, I'm going to go to a recording studio for this week. And they were like, would you not go into the Royal? And I said, I knew that if I wanted to go do that, I would likely be able to later. Mm-hmm. And this was the only pass I was going to get. So I wrote round a few, and I didn't really get much joy at all. And eventually I tracked down, Daddy knew Neil Martin. I think he taught him in St. Mary's. And he knew that he played the music. So I remember having a phone call with Neil when I was about 16, and he was in Scotland at the time. And I said, do you know any recording studio I could go to? And he put me on to Mud Wallace, who ran a studio in Randallstown.
I remember Mud.
Yeah, so during that week, all my friends had to be, it was this real big thing in school, like, what time do you have to be in for? And he's like, oh, I have to be in to meet the head of human resources at 8 a.m. and I better get up half an hour earlier and whatever. So I was on the phone to Mud. I was like, what time do you want me to be in for? I was super keen. And he goes, gobble. We're not going to be up till one. So, I mean, don't come before two. So I was thinking, well, what am I supposed to do for the morning? I had the morning off school then, and then I had to get the bus up to Randallstown. Was arriving at 2, but the last bus down from Randallstown was in at 6:30. So I was only getting a 4-hour day in this, and Mud was only kind of cranking into work at 2. So I was a wee bit kind of like, I'm raring to go at 8. There was no recording studio was going to be raring to go at 8. So I just stood there coiling cables until something was happening. And, you know, tidying up the studio, bringing the cups out and trying to be useful, but not really having a clue. It was just very funny.
Well, you did it. You know, that's the lesson there, isn't it? You went for that against advice. Did you want to take that further then and study at a higher level in music?
Yeah, I did, but I didn't really think it was realistic, just in terms of financing what was going to have to be on my own. Mm. And when I look at my UCAS form now, it was 2 physics courses and 4 sound engineering. So right. At the time, I really didn't think that's what I was going to do, but there must have been something just trying to keep it in there. Either way, I went for the physics and did 3 years of that, found it really fascinating, loved it from an interest point of view.
Where did you go?
I went to Cambridge, did astrophysics there, and...
As you do. Very casual. I went to Cambridge and did astrophysics.
It was a really interesting place. And there are lots of fascinating, really clever people there. Yeah. And so it was very inspiring. Not only that, but quite aside from the topic or the things I was studying, most people there are just always on. Yeah. You know, if they're not doing their work that they're supposed to be there for, they're founding radio stations and learning 4 languages and taking, you know, hitchhiking to Africa. And there's just a lot going on. So add to that all the sort of ridiculous balls and things that you can go to and the wonderful, some ways, traditions. Yeah. It's just a really interesting place.
Did you get like 100 A-levels then?
No, I got 4.
4 good ones.
For good ones.
Honestly, yeah. And in terms of going to Cambridge and studying astrophysics, and I'm not asking this because you're from West Belfast, so let me get that out of the road first of all, because I'm thinking of if I'd have gone there or any of my pals had gone there, I think we'd have had chips on our shoulder and would have felt a bit kind of, oof, Cambridge, you know, we'd have had preconceptions about what the people were like, that they were all toffs, that they were all this, that and the other. How did you feel going to Cambridge, like a place with that kind of reputation? Did you feel up to it? Did you feel entitled to be there? Did you feel you had every right to be there? All the rest of it.
But there's a few things about that. One of them is that you kind of go from the place that you know, and yeah. That was my home. That my home was the place I knew, and it was a place where you were always encouraged to make sure that you tried to the best of your ability, and that you were true to yourself. And so that was the place I was coming from. I also had 2 older sisters who had already gone.
Wow. Now, to I think, Cambridge?
Yeah, and 2 more after me. And I think that me...
Is your family in the Guinness Book of Records for several things, I suspect?
But I think it's probably a better question to ask my oldest sister. She was the first one of us to go.
Yeah, she broke the mold, yeah.
And so for me, I had been to visit... And I'd fallen in love with the architecture mm-hmm. and the choral music.
Yeah.
And but in saying that, when you're in a family of 7, you try to find your own corner. Mm-hmm. And so I was very anxious not to study the same subject or, you know, to do the same things.
Unbelievable. It's not unbelievable you went to Cambridge, but that the whole family went.
Well, not the whole.
Well, a lot.
It was 2 didn't apply.
Yeah, your next choice, and Buchel Kail Dubh, or Do, as we'd say in the north.
A song.
Yeah.
From Eamon O'Fagan.
Tell me about Eamon.
Eamon is a singer, one of the best voices I've ever heard, and he died a few years ago. He's someone that I had the privilege of playing a lot of music with and learnt a lot from, and he could harmonise like no one I've ever met. It was just stuck in him. Like, if you ever had to go on a wee road trip with Eamon and he was singing along, usually the lyric, actually, and he'd be singing to a song that we knew, but he'd be singing in harmony. And I used to just marvel at him. And he would say, Do you know how annoying it is sometimes, though? Only to hear the harmony and not to be able to remember the tune. But a gorgeous, gorgeous voice.
Is uishle trea is is gillam yorn.
Éamon Ó Fuaigeán there, and an Buachaill Céil Dó, the choice of Una Monaghan, is with me in studio picking all the music tonight. We were talking so much, we still haven't got out of your childhood really at this point, Una, but that's fine. Well, we did. We got you to Cambridge. And
can I just say before we go?
Yeah.
See, that song, it's also a choice because it's one my granddad used to sing. He worked in the shipyards and he taught himself Irish in the 30s and he was in the Clonard. And apparently they used to have these Iha Arnulls, which I knew nothing about because I was long before I was born. But apparently that was the song granddad sang. You know, everyone had their piece.
Wow. There's just listening to you talking about Belfast, and I mean, I haven't been there. I haven't lived there in a long, long time and I don't know how it's changed really. But there would have been young people who lived, say in Andytown, where you grew up, who wouldn't have known the way around the city centre?
No, I mean, I don't.
Literally like, wouldn't.
Getting from A to B there is normally a bit wobbly for me because you weren't going to bring a load of kids into the city centre unless you had to get something or you had to bring them. So, yeah, I only really learnt about certain parts of the city when I came home after university. I was in Sark in the Sonic Arts Centre, which had opened the year before. I had just spent the 3 years doing physics, found it really tough, and thought, right, you know what, I'm taking a year for myself here, because all my friends from school had been largely at Queen's having great crack, and I'd spent most of my Saturdays in lectures, and thought, you know what, I'm at home, I'm going to Queen's, and I'm going to enjoy a year of studying Sonic Arts for me. Mm-hmm. And I fully expected after that, you know, to go and do something else that was, as I thought, maybe a bit more stable or sensible.
But you seem to be someone, you're not someone who didn't want to leave the community and was only happy within it. And you're not someone who was like, oh, I really want to get away.
No,
you,
and
you seem
I've
to
met,
be somewhere in the middle of those two, you know.
I'm really happy I'm somewhere in the middle, because I've met people who just said to me, even when I was in England, who said, oh, I just got out of Belfast.
Yeah.
And that will have been dependent on every person's own circumstance.
Yeah.
You know, there are people who needed to get out of Belfast and brilliant. And there are people who for whatever reason, managed not to see beyond that. Who again, for whatever reason and whatever happened to them, saw only what was going on. And that in its way can be very damaging too. And I'm just grateful, I guess, that I'm trying to find a way through the whole thing like everyone is.
But boy, I mean, you really struck out though. I mean, you went back to Cambridge then. Well, you Cambridge, then Queens, then back to Cambridge as a fellow then.
Yeah, I just spent 3 years over there from 2016 to 19 after the PhD.
And this time, this time it was music.
Yeah, I was so happy to be, you know, in a subject academically that I didn't think I would go that far in, because after the sound art work I had a great year at Queen's in terms of all of the improvisation that was happening there. Moving On Music used to run gigs there that could have been acoustic free improvisation or electronic music or computer music. There was acousmatic music, all sorts of things were going on in the Sonic Lab. And so that year was so formative for me. And after that, I worked in the Sonic Lab as a technical assistant in the Sonic Arts Research Centre. And Chris Corrigan, who's the technical manager there, brilliant sound engineer and a brilliant mentor, taught me everything really that I wanted to know. And it meant that I was listening to every gig, really, that came through the Sonic Lab, which for that period of time was brilliant.
And was it something you discovered there that led you to further studies at Cambridge? Was it something from there that you wanted to bring into an academic context and research more? Or?
Yeah, it was where I learned to listen.
Right.
And it was where my knowledge of music was properly expanded. Like, this is a story that I'm just thinking of now, which it was really embarrassing at the time, but in our first week or two, we were introduced to the Sonic Lab, which is this incredible cube of loudspeakers, 48 channels. You can have sound directed at you from all angles. And we were asked as the first module to bring in our own examples of listening. You know, our own music, what music were we interested in to listen to on this amazing instrument of sound. And at the time, I was flat out in the Beach Boys. So didn't I walk into a serious academic experimental music institution and hand them Beach Boys CD?
Quite
at the
right.
time, I was mortified.
Yeah,
the way,
right.
But people were coming in with, you know, Alvin Lucier. And later I learned about those artists. But at the time, yeah, I was a lot less fancy.
Your next choice is Chris Cutler and Fred Firth.
Yeah, and that's from this time.
Yeah.
They did a gig in Sonorities in 2006. Brilliant festival in the Crescent Arts Centre before it was done up, and I was just blown away.
Here we go. Chris Cutler there and Fred Frith, Washington is the piece. The choice of Una Monaghan, who's with me in studio. I'm just thinking, Una, when you started to listen to this kind of music, which on the face of it seems a million miles away from playing Irish tunes on the harp, did you see that there was a way of combining these, or did you think, right, did you sort of drop the traditional music for a while and throw yourself into this fully as a separate kind of a thing?
I was doing them, but in parallel. They didn't mix for the first while. I didn't stop either, but I didn't quite know how to combine them. Because when I was starting to hear that music, I was starting to learn about improvisation, and I was really just trying to work out how to do that as a musician and what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I do, something I think a lot about now is how musicians approach improvisation based on what their previous training has been. And I'm really interested in that, in terms of the Irish traditional musician, because, not to speak for everyone, but my experience of it has been playing a lot of dance music, playing a lot of dance tunes, which have a really strong rhythm. They're normally quite a set length. They have repeats. And you learn, you kind of absorb a skeleton of tunes, and then you hang the notes on that skeleton. And if you're suddenly asked to take away the skeleton, the thing that is inherent in all or nearly all of the music that you've played for years and years before that, like, where do you go as, well, how do you become an improviser out of that structure? And it's one of the things that drives what I try and get computers to do, is to bring me out of traditional music. Now, I don't mean to abandon it. I mean, I'm quite aware of the structure it's placed on me, but I also think that it's given me a real strong basis to be an improviser from.
I was talking to Quibian O'Reilly recently, and mm-hmm. you probably know him, and he was talking about, he's not trying to break out of the tradition, he's trying to break out of himself. And this technology and all the rest of that helps him do that.
Yeah, exactly. One of the reasons I didn't want to take physics much further is because I struggled to accept the approximations that were necessary to work through the problems.
Mm.
It's kind of weird because you're supposed to question in science. I'm not saying that they don't question, but I'm saying that the type of questioning was hampering me studying physics, and it doesn't hamper me studying music.
Did you do quantum physics as well?
I did a bit. It was more the bigger end of the scale because astro was bigger,
yeah.
So general relativity and things. But yeah, there was quantum physics in it too. I loved all of it. It's yeah. fascinating. And it did affect the way I thought, and it affected the way I logically moved through things.
Mm.
I think it makes me a good engineer because you don't sort of run at engineering problems. If something's not working at the end of a signal chain, you need to carefully go through to find out where.
Can it affect the way you go through a tune?
The physics?
Your knowledge of physics, yeah.
I mean, it must. Mm. You're made up.
You would have different ideas of the physical world that the rest of us would have, because we haven't gone into that territory, you know, about time and all the rest of it.
Yeah, but I also don't know what I know. Mm. You know, I need to be explaining my approach to something to realise where it affects it. But yeah, it must.
I think we need to take a break. Just before that break, let's just stay in Cambridge with this. I was in Cambridge once, not as a student. I hasten to add. One of the things I loved about it was you'd be passing some building and there would be choral music on it 3 o'clock in the day.
Oh, gorgeous. Someone's, it kills me. Like, you couldn't, and you'd be able to nip in and sit at the back of whatever chapel it was and get this world-class choral music. And I mean, I can't really listen to it recorded most of the time because it hits you in the throat, like.
Yeah. And what do you want to hear?
This is Allegri Miserere, although I loved this before I got anywhere near Cambridge. I was always on at St. Malachy's College to do this, and they were saying, when we get a soprano that can hit that top note, we'll do it. So.
And is this the choir of King's College singing it? I think it is. Allegri Miserere. And that's Allegri's Miserere, King's College Cambridge choir there, the choice of Una Monaghan, who's with me in the studio picking all the music. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. John Kelly here until 9 o'clock. Our guest tonight picking the music is Una Monaghan, who's a harpist, composer and a sound artist. She's going to be taking part, in fact we talk about it now, Una, New Music Dublin, which is next weekend. And I want to talk about your own project, Aineracht.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's to do with solo. So tell me a little bit about Aineracht.
It's a collection for solo traditional musicians and computer. So it started whenever I was trying to combine computer music and traditional music as a harp player. And I would write pieces for harp and electronics. And then I wondered about expanding that out to write for other instruments. But I really wanted to do it. When you think about traditional musicians, you're not really getting the instrument there, you're getting a person, and that's a whole package. So when I wanted to add computer to those people, I really thought about what kind of interaction they wanted, what kind of piece they wanted to be involved in, and what their approach was. And I would have ideas for themes for each of the pieces, and then we'd talk to the person about it, and we'd develop it based on how they responded to the computer patches that I'd made.
And what's in that for the musician, do you think? Now, I'll talk about your ideas about it in a minute, but for the musician, because I'm looking at some of the people you've got involved here, and they're serious people. You've got Paddy Glacken and Jack Talty and Sally O'Neill-Canavine and various other people. I mean, Paddy Glacken I know because he used to work here, and I often used to talk to him about it. He worked with John Cage, for instance, so he's prepared to go places. What do you add to what he does?
I think it's just any artist. If there's a way to express themselves, then they're going to be interested in that.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to work with that. Like, I arrive and I say, here's what I've got. Is that working for you? Are you feeling able to be creative in this environment? Are you down with the theme that we're getting across here? Do you like the melodies I've written? If you don't, we're going to change them.
Of course, I should point out, you've composed the pieces as well. It's not like Paddy plays a tune and you do something with it. It's not that.
Well, yes, but we're working from a traditional musician. So the music itself. So if we take Paddy's piece, for example, it's called Who Do You Play For? And I thought of it in terms of the traditional musician and all of the different contexts that they might be in. So they might be playing for the president, they could be playing at their mommy's funeral the next day, they could be on national TV, they could be playing at an awful St. Patrick's Day festival, you know, to people who aren't listening. Mm-hmm. So there's just loads of contexts there. And someone like Paddy, who's been doing this his whole life, has been in every one of those contexts. So he's playing. It's very much about traditional music and how that has been across his life. So he's playing traditional tunes in this piece. But we also have poetry from Kieran Carson and from Cathal O'Sharkey. So I wrote a load of these statements, like play for the president, play for, you know, a function, play for the radio because you have to promote the show. All of these statements that are a real part of playing traditional music and any music. And then I rang Kieran Carson and I was like, I'm putting together a piece of music. I've got all these statements. This is kind of what I'm thinking of. What do you think of the writing here? And he said, oh yeah, I've already done that. And I thought it was really funny. Mm-hmm. Of course, it was in a passage in his work, Last Night's Fun. Yeah. So I got
which is a great book, by the way.
Brilliant book. Yeah. I got him to record that passage. And then I said to Paddy, like, it's daft to be writing this work without referring to the language. So I'm going to have this translated into Irish. Who do you think should do it for me? And he said, well, Cathal O'Sharkey. So I got in touch with him. And then I got a phone call and I didn't recognise the voice. And he says, hi, Una Shaw Cathal and Shaw. And I says, great. And he said, I've finished what you asked me to do. And he starts reading. And he hasn't actually translated the work. He's written a whole epic poem in Irish around this theme. So that really then shaped the composition. The first half of it does have those statements flying out at random from Kieran and from me. But Cathal's work, I kind of thought I should leave a bit more intact.
This is going to seem like a terrible tease because we're not going to play it now because we don't have it. It hasn't happened yet. It hasn't happened yet. But I should say, if you do want to hear Aineracht, which features Paddy Glack and Salio Ní Canavan, Pauline Scanlon, Jack Talty, and Noreen McAllister, who's there on sculpture. So sculpture and computer, how's that going to work?
I've worked with Noreen before on a sound art piece where you approach the sculptures and through capacitive sensing, they triggered sound. So it was a way of bringing sound into a piece of visual art that wasn't moving. But in this piece, the sculptures are going to be there in parallel. So there are five sculptures to complement the Aineracht. They're not going to be making noise. They're going to be part of the visual work.
And I suppose that's where the term new music becomes useful, because there's no name for what you're doing, is there?
It's an amalgamation of lots of things.
Yeah.
And I guess that's anyone who hears it might have a different name for it, which is great.
Yeah, okay. So New Music Dublin 2020 is next weekend. We put all the details of your event and everybody else's events on the website, but their own website is newmusicdublin.ie. You'll find the full programme there. Pauline Oliveros, can we maybe play her now? Because I presume this is one of the people that you would have been inspired by in terms of the sort of work she got up to.
Yeah, she visited Sark a few times while I was there and I was able to hear her music. I was able to participate in one of her deep listening sessions.
Just explain a deep listening session. What's that?
It's a way of listening that she pioneered and developed. And it can be done alone, but she led one of these sessions with a whole group of people. And she uses different techniques to deepen your listening. And it was great to do that with her. I also have one of her books, which is a collection of her text-based scores, which are pieces for improvisation either within groups or as a soloist, and also ways of listening. So it's a book that I refer to again and again to help me play music, to help me listen. It's just someone I really admire and a real pioneer.
Music there from Pauline Oliveros, Bye Bye Butterfly, the choice of Una Monaghan, who's with me in studio. She, as you said, real pioneer, was doing this a long, long time ago.
Yeah, and in many ways on her own. Mm-hmm. In some of the contexts, the only woman too. Mm-hmm. So a really brilliant and a really lovely person.
Now for you, if you could leave aside the fact that you're involved in making this kind of music and you're curious about how she's done it, and what machine she's using and so on. As a listening experience, there may be times you'll want to listen to that and there'll be times it's the last thing you want to hear.
Yeah.
But that's okay, isn't it?
Totally. I love lots of music, but that's not to say I love it every day. Like my partner listens to a lot more music than me. I've really struggled to make time to listen to music, mostly because I'm trying to do it for a start. But secondly, when I'm listening to music, it's something that's really active and something that sets my head going. And so there are times I don't want to do that. And I do think his approach to music has really been in some ways restricted by having to live with me. Because some days I just don't want to hear.
But then are you not the kind of person, you know, when you think about John Cage and others, who I'm sure you've studied intently, even in silence, are you not then listening to distant voices and starting to enjoy the sound of passing cars and alarms going off?
Yeah, I mean, I made a new version of Roratorio in 2012, where I spent a year walking around with a recording device because I had a list of pieces of recordings that I had to collect for this new piece. And when you are switched on for a year with a mental list of sounds you need to collect and you're going through your life checking off all the time if that sound is happening because you need to grab it, you do get to a point where it's normal to be listening to every noise. Mm. There's a lot of real, actual sound-based noise, but there's also a lot of mental noise and it's very hard to get quiet and I do safeguard it a lot of the time.
I heard conversations between John Cage and Martin Feldman talking about...
I love those conversations. Like, I have a few books like that where it's conversations between two people and they're some of the most fascinating ways of getting information.
Well, you'd enjoy these ones. They're online. Mm. And they're talking about... Martin Feldman is complaining about the amount of transistor radios on the beach. So
Same back in the day.
Well, it dates it, you know. And presumably Coney Island or somewhere, and just all these transistor radios playing all this music at the same time and the racket. And John Cage just thinks it's brilliant. He loves it. And he said that he wrote a piece for radio. Mm-hmm. So now when he goes to the beach, he listens and he thinks they're just playing my piece. So, you know, you can...
I bet when he wanted it quiet, I bet that does not translate to every single transistor radio we heard he loved. Do you know what I've taken to doing now is carrying about a wee tiny set of earbuds that if someone's beside me on a trip or on a mode of transport is listening to their phone or whatever, I'll just silently say, here, do you want them? Because I once sat in a plane where a child had Frozen on repeat, and I'm telling you, 20 times. And I did find it really hard.
Mm. Your next choice is John Arida. Inevitable that he would turn up, I suspect, in your listening choices. What would you like to hear?
Yeah, this is a section of Misha Era, and I mean it's just beautiful for loads of reasons, and it does get me in the heart. And I wonder about why it does, you know, because the melodies that he's used are, of course, derived from many tunes that we would know. Some would be called rebel songs, and you do wonder what part of it is getting you in the heart. Is it the joy of an orchestra, or is it what that means, the cheer gra? I realised later on when my brother's a bassoonist, and when he was playing professionally in orchestras then, I realised that my choice to go with harp and not violin in a way meant that I wasn't really going to be playing in orchestras. And it struck me that that was something, a real loss that I've had. And so I just love the orchestra. ¶¶
Music from Misha Era, from Sean Arida. Una Monaghan with me in studio there. Una, you got very moved listening to that. Orchestra just does it to you.
It really does. And I think it's partly because I can't play in it. You know, it's the richness of the sound as well. And the might of it. I just love orchestra work.
You've said heart a couple of times. It gets you in the heart. And I suppose there'd be a perception then that someone working with computers and machines and all the rest of it would be less soulful, have less heart. Do you know what I mean? That like people thought, you know, Kraftwerk were kind of, mechanical. And in fact, you know, the music is very danceable and quite soulful, and I'm not sure why. So it's not necessarily the case that someone like you is into machines. It doesn't therefore follow that you are a machine.
No, there has to be heart in everything that I'm trying to do with the computer. Has to be. You're trying to make a connection with you, firstly, the musician, and then you're trying to make a connection with other people. And I'm just trying to get things that'll help me do that.
And are there circumstances where you would need to be careful that machines get in the way of that?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I did a project a couple of years ago with people who were working in AI. And one of the pieces for Eanoracht features this. And it was a recurrent neural network that had been trained on over 23,000 tunes, traditional music that is uploaded to thesession.org. So it's a website where all these tunes are notated. And the computer learns from all of this data and it then spits out its own tunes. So given the amount of tunes up on thesession.org, it's done a pretty good learning process through all of that, and the tunes that it spits out are in some cases pretty close to traditional music. And so this piece has three of those tunes that are computer generated trad music. But when I described it, this project, to traditional musicians, I was struck by their unease. And it's interesting to me. I also understand it. There are computers writing music now, and it's very interesting to think about.
And yet, you know, you were very moved by the orchestra, which suggests the orchestra really, or, you know, a bunch of people playing acoustic instruments is the height of it.
Yeah, and I wonder about unison there and about strength in numbers. So many different people all playing together. And the concept of that, and just the sound it produces. You've everything covered in there.
Your next choice, Una, is Joni Mitchell.
It is.
When did you find Joni?
I mean, fair play to Joni, obviously, but the first time I heard this song was being sung by Pauline Scanlon.
Right.
And that's what introduced me to Case of You. And if I had Pauline singing it now, I'd probably have put her in. But a brilliant track. But yeah, first heard it sung by Pauline and Donna Hennessy.
And would you be a lyrics person? Because great lyrics in this song.
Great lyrics in this song. I don't think I'm one or the other, lyrics or not. There are some songs like this one where I know the lyrics backwards and I love them. There's other songs where I'm not absorbing the lyrics and I couldn't tell you what they're about. Mm-hmm. So I think it just depends on the piece.
Okay, Joni Mitchell, A Case of You.
You said, I am as constant as a northern star, and I said, constantly in the darkness.
And that's Lau and Ghosts. Before that, Joni Mitchell, Case of You, the choice of Una Monaghan, who's with me in studio, picking all the music tonight. Tell me about Lau.
Lau are a trio.
Yeah.
They're based in Scotland. Chris Drever, Aidan O'Rourke and Martin Green. and they work across traditional and experimental music. And they're one of the most inspirational artists I've met. They're all individually brilliant, and in that trio, they're amazing too. That song as well, the theme and the topic of it, I find really important. But they've whole albums and live shows. When I go to the live shows, I must admit I'm usually watching their engineer, because he looks like he's playing the piano. Yeah. Like, there's so much going on, and they've beautiful lighting on stage. Everything is done brilliantly, and yeah, listen to them.
What's the experience like for you of doing sound engineering? How do you approach it?
Like a musician, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But with the knowledge that it's on you at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And the usual thing where if it's going right, nobody notices, and if it's going wrong, you've got all the audience blaming you. So I try to remember that it's about the musicians. And if you don't have comfortable musicians, you don't have a comfortable gig. But I also love it. Like, I engineer for mostly traditional and acoustic music or experimental and multi-channel. And I work as a live engineer. So that thing where it's related to my interest in performance as well. You know, you've got an audience, you've got connections. Things have to be immediate. Things have to be correct. There has to be workarounds. Whereas with studio engineering, you could, time and money permitting, be there forever tinkering with stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas at 8 o'clock, the audience are coming in and the damn show has to be ready. And I love that.
So I suppose, you know, not everybody might be aware of the contribution a sound engineer makes during a gig, because the assumption is you just make sure everybody gets heard and there's no feedback.
Mm.
But what you're talking about is really contributing to the sound in a very active way throughout the whole show.
Yeah, you're working the whole night.
But you're adding sounds as well.
Sometimes, depends on the gig.
Yeah.
Whether you're asked to be a creative sound engineer or whether you're asked to reproduce what they do.
Well, what would the creative sound engineer do then?
They might design a multi-channel rig. So I've just come off last year working on Jennifer Walsh and Tim Morton's new opera, Time, Time, Time. And that, there was a lot going on there. The musicians were in multiple locations. So you had four electronic musicians on stage and then four acoustic ones within the audience. So if you have mics positioned in the room and you have up to 16 or 24 channel speaker array, then you have a bit more control over where those sounds are going to be positioned and how they move within the piece. And for a long form piece like that, over 90 minutes, they want the sounds to change the location of where they're coming from.
Yeah.
So you get to be creative with what they're giving you. But then for a traditional gig, I work for some traditional bands too, and there the brief is different, because they may rehearse and they may be most comfortable playing acoustically. So if their stage does not feel, if the balance of their monitors on stage is not optimal for them, you know, they're not playing a piece of music that's written down. They're playing something from within. And if they're unhappy, you're not going to get the music they want to make. So I really think for the traditional musician that has come from an acoustic situation, you really have to work to get the acoustic sound right and the monitor mix right.
That's been cracked now, though, hasn't it? That's doable. There were many years when it was very, very tricky, particularly at festivals and so on. It was very, very difficult for any kind of acoustic group.
Yeah, it is definitely doable. Still doesn't always happen, though.
Mm. Okay. Your next choice, Usher's Island.
Yeah.
That's one of Donald's bands, isn't it?
It is, yeah. One of the bands that I engineer for, and just two great tunes. There's few things nicer than being at the back of a big hall listening to this.
So who's in Usher's Island now? Remind me of the personnel.
That is Andy Irvine, Donal Lunny, Paddy Glacken, John Doyle and Mike McGoldrick.
That's a good band. There you go. That's Usher's Island. Mickey Doherty's and Gan Anyam, the choice of Una Monaghan, who's with me in studio. Una's part of the Dublin New Music Festival, which is happening this weekend for their own piece, Aineracht, which features Paddy Glacken, who's one of the musicians there in Usher's Island, if I'm right. Yeah, Paddy's in Usher's Island, yeah. So, Una, we were talking about sound engineering there, and in the course of it, you mentioned Jennifer Walsh. Tell me a little bit, because we're going to play her next, tell me a little bit about Jennifer Walsh, because you're not entirely on your own in terms of doing what you do. There are these other musicians around who, not everybody will know them, but they're there and they've been doing this work, doing their work for a long, long time.
Yeah,
So tell me about Jennifer in particular.
Jennifer Walsh is a composer, and I first encountered her when I was working on my PhD. And I was trying to find out about previous occasions where people had combined electronic music and Irish traditional music. And Jennifer has a project called Aisteach, which is a history of the Irish avant-garde. And she has a website, and I looked this up, and it's a really brilliant performance project and collection of imaginary histories of the Irish avant-garde. But I was quite far into this before I clocked the word imaginary. So I was really excited about all of these examples of experimental Irish traditional music, which had been conceived by her and a lot of other artists that she works with. So at the time I was furious, because I'd spent days, you know, thinking, oh, this will be great and I can put this into the research. And a few years later, I was working on a PZ performance as part of a Moving On Music gig, and she was playing in the second half. And so that was the first time I got to meet her. Met her at the bar and I said, you know how raging I was with you when I found out that. And so from then, I've grown to really respect her work. And I went to The Worlding recently at the Model in Sligo, which was a big, large-scale installation work of hers. 13 Vices that we're going to hear was a work that she did with Brian Irvine. And last year, I've been working with her on Time. And during that, I've been able to see more about her compositional process and about how she works with other artists, how she collaborates, how to be a composer in the way that she is, how to be a champion of other artists, how to be great to work with. So musically, I find her really exciting, really unique. And then as a person, I just find her a powerhouse and someone who is really supportive.
Now, we can't play all of this because it's 15 minutes long, but this is from 13 Vices. Jennifer Walsh and Brian Irvine.
Endangered. In fact, current populations are healthy and at almost historic highs. Fact. The greenhouse effect is a natural and valuable phenomenon without which the planet would be uninhabitable.
God, it's all happening there, isn't it? Una Monaghan with me in studio. Una, it's interesting though, you've just chosen as Jennifer Walsh and Brian Irvine there from 13 Vices live. And yet, you know, when you listen to that, and that's, I suppose, it's for a lot of people listening, it's out there, it's avant-garde, it's way out. And yet, you know, there were composers like Schoenberg and Webern and Alban Berg. And then when you hear the sax coming in, there was Coltrane and Ornette Coleman and all these people. Who were there a long, 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 long time ago, you know? That's not to take away from any of this, but what I'm saying is there were these people who were so far ahead. It's kind of astonishing to think of that.
Yeah, and we're all humans and everything's always mixed up. Yeah. It's great.
And again, that's music, as we were joking about it earlier. You might want to listen to it one day. You might want to hear it again for a long time, but that's okay.
That's totally okay. And it can be exciting one day and a real headache the next.
Yeah.
And again, a lot of these choices are based around live experiences. So I saw that piece in real life, and that'll be different from hearing it recorded because you're there in the energy of it.
And what she does there, again, if you haven't heard it before, it sounds bonkers. But if you're in a room with it, as you said, the live experience is completely different.
Yeah, still pretty bonkers, but full of energy and excitement.
Yeah, it's exciting as opposed to confusing.
Yeah, and really shows you what the voice can do, which we only really ever hear a fraction of in certain styles of music.
I'd say you'd like to work with Jennifer, would you?
Yeah, well, we have over the last year, but just as an engineer.
Harriet Tubman.
Harriet Tubman.
Now, this is confusing me because I know Harriet Tubman, the historical figure. Mm-hmm. So what are we going to listen to here?
This is a trio that I met last year. And they are J.T. Lewis on drums, Melvin Gibbs on bass, and Brandon Ross, who's a guitarist. And a wonderful trio of musicians and people. I learned a lot from them about how to collaborate. We did a project in Kilkenny Arts Festival with Niall Valley, Ian O'Rourke and Karen Casey last year. And so everyone brought their musical experience to it. And a few days of putting a piece together, and you really learned how to be a calm musician with those people. They're so skilled. And then I was able to...
A calm musician?
Yeah.
As opposed to what?
Well, just it can be quite a frightening place sometimes. And when you come together to make something, there was a sense of calm confidence with them. And as soon as they start playing, you hear why. But really lovely people, and I learned so much from them, and I really like their music.
Harriet Tubman adapted. Adapted from a band called Harriet Tubman, the choice of Una Monaghan, who's with me in studio. We're just saying there, Una, nothing new under the sun. That's jazz to my mind.
Yeah, it's but, wonderful.
Now, when you're across as many types of music as you are, and you work with musicians from different fields and all that, is that more difficult than it would be if you just had one thing, one specific small thing that you did, and you concentrated on that forever? Because you have to spread yourself, I guess, you know?
Yeah, I think if I was just doing one thing, there's always the fear that if that thing doesn't work out, what do you do with your effort then? What do you do with your emotional hole that you're left with? So sometimes, I mean, I'm interested, really interested in all the things I'm doing, but I think there's also a little drop of when you work towards something so hard, you can't really afford to go up and up and up emotionally and then it be the only thing there is, you know. Because then if you're trying to go out in that stage to do the thing, there's so much riding on it then that I find it's too miserable a pressure to be under. And so if you say, well, I'm going to do this gig and I'm putting as much as I can into it and it's a really kind of nervy, creative thing for me to be doing, but if it turns out it's shit, well, I've got this other gig with a collaborator next week and maybe that'll be better and I probably won't cry for the whole week, you know. It's partly being interested in lots of stuff, but it's also keeping it so that you're not going to just crash.
Because you see, there are some artists, well, sometimes they are painters, but musicians I'm thinking of, who you could say if you were being cruel about them, that they just repeat themselves. Or to be kinder, you'd say they have a style. This is their style and they stick to it.
Yeah, and I mean, if something's working and if it means something to an audience, then why not? There is definitely space for being doing that. The other thing is I really respect musicians and artists who work on one thing. I mean, there's only so many hours in the day. So by doing many things, there are some things I'm not doing. And I do think about that. You know, there are aspects of my work that I would be better at if I was only doing that. So you have to just pick the method that works for you. And this is currently what I'm interested in. But I do look at people who play one instrument 6 hours a day. Mm. And I think, wow, that is something I cannot do.
Kit Philippa?
Yeah.
Broken to be rebuilt. Tell me about this.
Kit Philippa is an artist, one of the artists where you go to see them and you're just struck by their music immediately. The amount of emotion that they put in to their work. This piece, when I heard it first, it really hit me lyrically. The way that it developed, so it starts out quite sparse and then the choices that they make with the instrumentation that they add later. So I think you hear this person and you especially their live show again, not so much the recorded versions, but when you hear this person live, you're changed.
Kit Philippa, Broken to Be Rebuilt.
Like the tide without its moon, is a life without a light. She walks blindly by despair, to grief and sorrow's dark end.
And that's Kit Philippa, Broken to Be Rebuilt. It comes from an EP, Broken to Be Rebuilt, the choice of Una Monahan, who's with me tonight. Una, I really, really enjoyed talking to you tonight, but I just want, before you go, to mention again Anorakt, which is part of New Music Dublin. It's a world premiere, and it's on Thursday the 27th, 9:30, at the National Concert Hall. And the performers, it'll be yourself. And you'll be playing the harp on the night, yeah?
I will, yeah. It's five pieces, each with a different artist with computer. So I'll do the harp and electronics one.
And how do you do that physically, harp and computer? Do you just keep the laptop by your side?
Well, there's different interaction for each one. So yeah. With mine, my piece has motion sensor. Some of them have MIDI controllers. Some of them are controlled by the audio from the instrument. So some of them you need to be closer to the computer than others.
And Paddy Glacken, Sal Yogni Canavan, Pauline Scanlon, Jack Talty on concertina, and Noreen McAllister on sculpture.
Yeah.
Where are the sculptures going to be?
The sculptures will be around the room.
Terrific.
And they're in bronze.
Wow. Sounds amazing. And I should say too, you know, I remember there was a tribute night to Liam O'Flynn in the National Concert Hall, and I was the MC, and that's the night we announced the Liam O'Flynn Award, and you won it, the first one.
I did. It's been a brilliant support for the work this year. It's enabled me to make this new music, so I've loved it.
It's extraordinary what you're doing, and I wish you every success with it, and thank you so much, Una, for coming in. I enjoyed your musical choices, and I enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you very much, John.
And we'll see you on the 27th at the National Concert Hall, New Music Dublin, Anorakt by Una Monahan. Your last choice is what?
Yes, this is Lyra Pramuk. This is a person I met in America. She is a trained opera singer, and she's based at the minute in Berlin. She's a vocalist and an electronic musician. And I believe this track is only out a couple of days, so we'll be listening to it together. But I really respect her work, and I'm excited for her new album that's just been released, Fountain.
Una, thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.